Okay, yes. All right. Just very briefly, welcome to part two of the series on Introduction to Jewish Philosophy. It's a pleasure to have Dr. Reinhold with us, who was teaching at U of T, I guess, is still a little bit online, a professor at Yeshiva University. And we had lots and lots of wonderful comments on last week's classes. So this we're going to move to modern Jewish philosophy, and we'll let you take it away. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Anybody has any questions, it's much easier. Just put it in the chat box. And then maybe at the end of class, people can sort of unmute themselves and ask the questions. But in the meantime, if during the class, you can put any questions in chat box. Okay, everybody enjoy. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Last week, we introduced medieval Jewish philosophy. And I'm just going to spend maybe, five minutes, if that, saying something about the way medieval Jewish philosophy worked, or the way that at least we described it. So that we can be set up for what differs about modern Jewish philosophy. And when it comes to modern Jewish philosophy, there are similarities, but there are quite significant differences. And that's kind of what I want to explore with you this evening. And I suppose to begin with, the way that we initially defined medieval Jewish philosophy last week was in terms of a clash, right? A clash between the so-called Jewish worldview and an external worldview. Some kind of Aristotelian worldview was really, de rigueur when it comes to medieval Jewish philosophy. And what those thinkers are doing is trying somehow to either reconcile Judaism with that form of philosophy, or showing why that philosophy is mistaken and Judaism's got it right. Yeah, so, effectively, that was sort of the grand picture of how medieval Jewish philosophy is done. And there's a set syllabus and a kind of canon, right? If I were to ask people to name the great medieval Jewish philosophers, I am sure that many, many people would come up with an identical list. And if you list what they're actually dealing with, again, there's kind of a set project there. They all talk about the creation question. They all talk about the prophecy question. They all talk about divine attributes. They all are dealing with the same basic issues. Now, when it comes to modern Jewish philosophy, one little kind of note before we begin, is it's much more difficult to talk about the canon, right? Just in terms of thinkers, because the fact is, I have no idea who they're still going to be reading in 500 years' time. Yeah, so when talking about kind of modern Jewish philosophy, at this point, you've got Spinoza and you've got Mendelssohn kind of established. Spinoza obviously is an interesting case in terms of the extent to which he's to be considered a Jewish philosopher. But let's take Spinoza as one, Mendelssohn as another. After that, right now, you've got figures like Martin Buber, Franz Rosenzweig. After that already, it starts to get a little bit more controversial, right? Rabbi Soloveitchik is one, maybe, but he wouldn't necessarily appear on everybody's list. Emmanuel Levinas is another one, very trendy right now. Who knows? Give it a few hundred years. So when it comes to modern Jewish philosophy, a little bit more questionable, who are going to be the figures come the time. That's just an aside. We're not going to deal with specific thinkers and their views necessarily tonight. What's more significant is one would think that the problem for modern Jewish philosophers is really no different from that of medieval Jewish philosophers. And the reason for that is, we're going to have a go at sharing here the handout for tonight. I'm hoping that in a moment everyone can see that. We all can see the texts there. If the sound goes off or funny like it did last week, please let me know and we'll get out of this. But if you look at the first couple of quotes, which are medieval, right, they're from Maimonides. But if you look at what he says there, you might think that surely modern Jewish philosophy is just the same thing, right? Why? Have a look at Maimonides here from the Guide, Part 1, Chapter 31, where he says, "In all things, whose true reality is known through demonstration, There is no tug of war and no refusal to accept a thing proven, unless indeed such a refusal comes from an ignoramus who offers a resistance that is called resistance to demonstration. Right? Well, what's the point that he's making there? Right? So what he's saying there is that, look, obviously, there is a, you know, if there is a matter, right, where we know through demonstration, what's demonstration? Demonstration is an Aristotelian form of proof, but it's an absolute proof, right? If you've demonstrated something, then no rational person can deny it, right? That's demonstration. And what Maimonides is telling us there is, look, if there's something that has been philosophically demonstrated, then you can't really have any battle over its truth unless you're an idiot, right? Unless you're an ignoramus, right? Nobody's going to resist something that is demonstrated. And the classic example he gives is, in the next brief quote below, that the deity is not a body has been demonstrated. From this, it follows necessarily that everything that in its external meaning disagrees with this demonstration must be interpreted figuratively, right? Which in ordinary language simply means Aristotle, or philosophy, has demonstrated absolutely that God is not a body. So if anything in Tanakh implies that he is, clearly you've got to reinterpret it, right? So there are the easy cases, Yad Chazakah, Zrona Tuyah, right? Nobody thinks God has a hand. Nobody thinks he has an arm. We happily reinterpret that. We're not going to dwell on Maimonides today since we're looking at modern Jewish philosophy, but fact is, when it comes to Maimonides, there's a heck of a lot more than that that he's going to reinterpret. But basic point, philosophy demonstrates something, proves it to be absolutely undeniably the case. Surely Judaism has to simply reinterpret itself to say the same, right? But if that's the case, how's it any different for modern philosophy, right? If you have a modern philosophy, right, the philosophy of, say, Descartes or Kant, and it's demonstrated something to be the case, you got to do the same, right? So what's the difference, right? Is not modern Jewish philosophy just the same as medieval Jewish philosophy? They're just dealing with different figures, right? They had to deal with Aristotle. We have to deal with someone else. Well, it's not quite the case, because there are certain unique challenges that come up in modern Jewish philosophy. And ultimately, as the evening goes on, we're going to make a distinction, or I'm going to stipulate a distinction between modern and contemporary Jewish philosophy. But if we start with modern Jewish philosophy, right? And by modern Jewish philosophy, we're kind of starting at Spinoza. We're sort of starting in the 16th century. And what is it that makes it modern? What is it that inaugurates the modern age? Well, in part, the scientific revolution, the move from Aristotle to Newton, right, to Newton and Galileo, to a very different view of the universe, and the Enlightenment. So what were the specific challenges that A, the scientific revolution, and B, the Enlightenment, brought to bear that differ in any way from whatever it was medieval Jewish philosophers were dealing with? And I want to start with science, because in a way, most people would go straight to the Enlightenment, but I think the scientific question is the more interesting one. Because what you have at this point is a, as I say, a kind of a shift from Aristotle's scientific version of the universe to a more modern view, that of Newton, Galileo, where they see the universe very differently. And what is the key difference? What is the central difference between them? Aristotle's universe was purposive, was teleological. Meaning what? Meaning that he would explain things in terms of their purpose. Okay? So, everything in the universe, according to Aristotle, had a certain form or essence, and that essence kind of determined what's going to happen to it. Right? So, to take a really simple example of a banana tree, all right? Okay, you plant the seed. The essence of that seed is that it has the potential to become and produce bananas, right? As long as you do the right things to it, those bananas will be produced. And the fact is that that potential's built into the essence of the seed. And that means that in explaining what's going to happen to it, we can appeal to its purpose, its essence, its form. And for Aristotle, that's true of everything, true of human beings. What is the form or essence of human beings? It's that we're rational animals. We have the potential to become, actualize our rationality. And you can explain things about human beings by appeal to that. So for Aristotle, to give a scientific explanation of what's going on in our world, he would appeal, and he to all of these thinkers, this was scientific, right? You would appeal to the purpose of the thing, right? Where do things get their purpose from? Right? Where does this purpose come from? If you think about the Newtonian picture of the universe, purposes are out the window. Right? Everything's just mechanical, clockwork. You don't explain things scientifically by appealing to what they might become. You explain things scientifically by what came before, cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect. It's a mechanical, clockwork universe, no appeal to purpose. Purpose out of the picture in Newton's universe. And that's really important. Because it suddenly squeezes God out of the picture. You see, however difficult it might have been for a medieval thinker, a medieval Jewish thinker, to try and reconcile his views with Aristotle, at the end of the day, God kind of had a purpose, if you'll forgive the pun. And his purpose was to give all the other purposes. Right, where do things get their purpose from? Who made that seed so that it would produce bananas? Who made human beings such that they are naturally given to exhibiting their rationality? God. Right? There is a place for God in Aristotelian science. Right? God is the thing, God is the being that gave the universe and everything in it all of these purposes. So the fact is that however much Aristotle's philosophy may have challenged certain traditional worldviews, the idea that you could be a religious thinker in that scientific universe wasn't difficult. In fact, it was almost required. Because if you're going to explain how things get their purposes, then God is the perfect explanation. Right, God was the perfect explanation of their scientific picture of the world. And as soon as you get rid of that, when Newton comes along and suddenly you don't need purpose, you can simply explain things as the result of a mechanical chain of events, then it's not so clear you need that God anymore, that you need a God to actually distribute purpose, to choose and make the purpose of a certain thing, the purpose of B, a certain other thing. So the God of the gaps that people often appeal to, right? People often appeal to the God of the gaps. What does God do? Well, he explains all the things he can't explain, the gaps. Newton closes one of those gaps because there's something that Aristotle needed explaining, purpose. And the Newtonian picture of the world didn't need that. So suddenly, the idea that the world, nature itself, needs a God, kind of starts to retreat. So one of the challenges in modern Jewish philosophy is the kind of lessening role of a God, right? You don't need God to explain that stuff anymore. That's problem number one, right? Problem number two that arises out of the Enlightenment is, not all that different from medieval Jewish philosophy other than in attitude. Because in medieval Jewish philosophy, as we've seen, if you can prove something absolutely, then Jews are going to have to kind of say the same. In the Enlightenment, there's a similar idea of reason, rationality is universal, right? Any rational person who is thinking correctly ought to arrive at the same conclusions, the same universal, rational conclusions. But like I say, Maimonides would have agreed with that. The difference is But in the medieval world, the vast majority of people also believed in religion. Religion is a source of truth, so is reason. They must be saying the same thing. But with the Enlightenment comes an increased skepticism regarding the power of tradition or revelation to give us those truths. So in the modern era, with the Enlightenment, you suddenly get an increasing skepticism regarding the truths of traditional religion, right? Universal reason is all powerful. Universal reason delivers truths. Tradition, suspicion, superstition, I should say, are things of which we ought to be suspicious. So you're suddenly in a realm where it's far less natural to think, well, Aristotle says X, but the Torah says Y, and well, if they're both true, which obviously they are, they must be saying the same. When it comes to the modern era, you've got philosophy saying A, Torah says something different. Well, maybe the Torah is just wrong, right? You don't have that same presumption necessarily of the truth of revelation. So the attitude begins to change, and you get a thinker like, to kick us off, Spinoza. And what does Spinoza think? Actually, a lot of the things Spinoza thinks are the same as the things Maimonides thinks, right? That's the truth. They aren't that far apart on their philosophical conclusions. But where they're miles apart is in the fact that Spinoza thinks those philosophical conclusions are just that, conclusions of philosophy. And if you look at the Torah, it doesn't say that, right? So Spinoza would agree, maybe, actually he doesn't, but that's, let us say, God doesn't have a hand, that he would agree with, right? Spinoza agrees God doesn't have a hand, but he would maintain, but look, the Torah says he does, so the Torah is just wrong. Whereas for Maimonides, the Torah says he has a hand, but clearly that's not what it means because the Torah is true. So we're suddenly doing Jewish philosophy in a completely new, different atmosphere world, one in which the truths of philosophy can challenge the truths of religion, and rather than force us to reinterpret the religion, can get us to reject it. And that indeed is what someone like Spinoza, for example, does with a number of truths that we would assume were in the Tanakh. So what do you do? What does a Jewish philosopher now do if you can't necessarily assume that the Torah and philosophy are saying the same thing? And if you don't need God to back up your scientific picture of the world? Well, there are a couple of things you can do. And one of them is very much of a piece with medieval thought, but with a twist. Because the first real major modern Jewish philosopher is Moses Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn being both a Jewish and B, a philosopher, the German Socrates, he was called. He beat Kant in a prize essay competition into second place, right? So Mendelssohn, in his day, was an immensely significant, respected German thinker who also was a very bold and proud representative of his religion, of Judaism. He's often, for some reason, out there in the world, people often associate him with Reform Judaism. And it's very difficult to know why. Mendelssohn himself was a Jew who maintained his adherence to rabbinic law, right? So he was kind of, so to speak, halachic. So there is a misapprehension of Mendelssohn for some reason out there amongst people who haven't actually maybe studied his thought or know a lot about his life. And Mendelssohn's interesting because amongst Enlightenment philosophers, they didn't all reject religion. There were a lot of Enlightenment philosophers who were religious, but their religion was a form of natural theology, natural religion, as in they believed still that there are certain truths of religion that you can prove philosophically. And Leibniz falls into this camp. maybe Kant up to a point, but they believed that you could rationally demonstrate A, the existence of God. You could still prove the truth of God's existence. B, they thought you could prove the immortality of the soul, philosophically prove that human beings have an immortal soul. C, they thought you could philosophically demonstrate some form of providence, okay, some form of God's control or guardianship of the world. So many modern thinkers, Enlightenment thinkers, thought that you could rationally prove those three things. That's all very well and good, but if anyone can do that through reason, what's the role of Judaism? What is Jewish philosophy? What becomes of that? And what's interesting is the way that Mendelssohn sort of retreats into an emphasis on maybe more practical matters. Mendelssohn famously speaks of Judaism in the following way. This is the final quote there under A. I believe that it begins. I believe that Judaism, writes Mendelssohn, knows of no revealed religion in the sense in which Christians understand this term. The Israelites possess a divine legislation, laws, commandments, ordinances, rules of life, instructions in the will of God as to how they should conduct themselves in order to gain temporal and eternal felicity. Propositions and prescriptions of this kind were revealed to them by Moses in a miraculous and supernatural manner. But no doctrinal opinions, no saving truths, no universal propositions of reason. What is Mendelssohn trying to say there? Mendelssohn's telling us that Judaism, Jewish revelation, isn't revelation of philosophical truths. Philosophy can tell you that. You don't need revelation at Sinai to teach you the truths that reason can teach you about God and the universe, right? You just don't need to. Interestingly, Mendelssohn's got a whole argument actually as to why it wouldn't be fair for those things to be taught at Ma'amad Har Sinai, right? Revelation at Sinai, right? He doesn't think a benevolent God, right? A good, just God would teach just this tiny little nation these truths that are essential for human beings to live a good life. Right, wouldn't be fair. A fair, just God wouldn't teach essential truths just to a little tribe of people, right? That wouldn't be right. What about the whole of the rest of the world? Are they to be left bereft of knowledge that they need? Mendelssohn thinks not. So the fact is, Judaism for him can't be about teaching that kind of stuff. What does Judaism reveal to us? As he says it there, laws, commandments, mitzvot. Jewish revelation for Mendelssohn, and therefore, I suppose, in a sense, Jewish philosophy, is really concerned with mitzvot and their continuing relevance. Because the big threat, of course, in Enlightenment thought would be the particularism of Jewish practice, right? We've said that for the Enlightenment, reason is king, reason rules, and reason's universal, right? 2 + 2 = 4, rational. Everyone believes it. You don't have to be a particular religion. Anything that's particular, anything that only applies to kind of a little, you know, segment of, say, the population, well, that can't be rational. It's not philosophical, right? You can't have math and science that only applies to particular people. In the same way, in the Enlightenment, philosophy cannot be only applicable to a particular nation or people. Philosophy is just the truth. And the problem that Jewish philosophers then have to address is our way of life isn't universal. Our rituals aren't universal. They're not even meant to be. We don't expect anybody else to keep kosher, right? We don't expect the world to be having a Seder in a couple of weeks' time. Right? It's just for us. But if it's just for us, then by definition, according to the Enlightenment, it's not rational. So Mendelssohn here is giving us this key idea. Judaism primarily, Jewish faith primarily, is about mitzvot. That's what our revelation is. It's do's and don'ts. It's not something that is couched as a philosophy, right? The Torah, the Tanakh, if you think about it, the Tanakh doesn't really teach you much about the nature of God qua philosophy. It tells us all kinds of things about God, as we know, some of them we don't think are true, like that he has a hand, right? So it's not really presented as a philosophical work. And medicine thinks that's fine. It's not meant to be a philosophical work, right? Philosophy takes care of itself. Judaism teaches us laws. And one of the key things he wants us to do, therefore, is understand how those laws might somehow contribute to some sort of universal picture, even though they themselves are only to be performed by us. So, where are we so far? We seem to have something akin to the medieval picture, where what you have is a philosophical worldview and a Jewish worldview. Do they match or do they not? Certain people think they don't, and so much the worse for Judaism. That's Spinoza. Certain people, like Mendelssohn, think they sort of do, but Judaism isn't really interested in teaching us the philosophical stuff because you can go and study that as a philosopher. And therefore, there's almost a retreat, right? What Judaism is really about is its practice. And as a Jewish philosopher, therefore, if you're building on that picture, I mean, number one, you can do just straight philosophy and try and prove the existence of God, try and prove the immortality of the soul. Mendelssohn did that. He wrote books dedicated to each of those topics. But those weren't part of his Jewish writings. Those were just works in philosophy. His one key work in Jewish philosophy, Jerusalem, the one that we've quoted here, doesn't deal with those questions. It deals much more with practical questions, political questions of the day. Jewish emancipation at this point is in the air, but primarily with the challenge to Jewish practice. Jewish practice is not universal, therefore, Jewish practice is not rational. What are you going to do? So there's a sense in which Jewish philosophy retreats more into the practical sphere, at least in the modern age. And in the modern age, which to this point I'm only taking it to up to the 20th century, therefore, Jewish philosophers were kind of doing something very close to what medieval Jewish thinkers were doing, whether it's Spinoza, Mendelssohn, a bit later, Hermann Cohen. Hermann Cohen kind of was just taking a form of Kantian philosophy and showing that that's what Judaism teaches too. Okay? But then things change. Because as we enter the 20th century, philosophy itself starts to think rather differently about this Enlightenment view of reason, this idea that reason is this universal thing and every rational person will come to the same rational conclusions. And just to give you an example here, right, or just to give you a, I suppose an anecdote, and you can substitute your own experiences similarly here. I used to teach at King's College in the Department of Theology and Religious Studies, and when I was originally there, I was the only Jewish member of the faculty. And I had, many colleagues. Some of them were very religious people of other faiths, mainly Christianity, a couple of Muslims. And, they were, number one, they were very, very intelligent people, right? These were academics, PhDs, brilliant people. Number two, I considered them my friends. Number three, however, man, they believed some weird stuff, right? I mean, yeah, I'm Jewish. Right? And therefore, the belief that God had a son who was resurrected days after he died, it's just bizarre. What rational person's going to believe that? But similarly, they would look at me. I certainly hope they thought he's kind of an intelligent guy. And I certainly hope they thought he's my friend. But one thing I know they thought, but man, he does some really bizarre things, right? What's with the food thing and what's with the home early on Fridays in the winter thing, and right? Now, what's going on there? Are those people not rational? Right? I think it would be very arrogant and empirically problematic for me to say that they're all irrational. You know what? They can't follow an argument. If only they could follow an argument properly, they'd all be Orthodox Jews like I am. Right? That doesn't seem right. Similarly, them looking at me, right? Now, maybe they could, you know, I was the individual there. But, you know, looking at all Jews in that light, right? They really think that none of us can follow an argument properly, that we're all irrational. It seems strange, right? It seems very difficult for any of us to think that a member of any other religion who is an intelligent, you know, sincere, authentic purveyor of that religion is irrational and incapable of following an argument. Is that really what's going on there? Like I say, difficult. So it's interesting that in the 20th century, and as the 20th century proceeds, philosophy becomes a little more skeptical about its own abilities to find the truth with a capital T. Because up to this point, we've just been assuming there's this thing, it's called the truth. Any rational person can get there. And, you know, presumably, if you believe in Judaism, we have it, right? Maimonides certainly believed that, by the way, right? Judaism has the truth, all of it. Islam's got some of it, and Christianity's got less of it. This is Maimonides' estimation of things. But Judaism's got it all. There's this one thing, it's called truth. We're all trying to get it. We got it. In the modern era, that kind of changes because there's this recognition that it might not be the case that knowledge of all truths, that knowledge of some of the most important truths, is something that we can gain by, so to speak, taking ourselves out of the equation. And I'll explain what I mean by that. You see, the ideal in the Enlightenment, indeed the ideal that up to a point still reigns supreme in certain scientific endeavors, is that our task is to know the way the world is, right? The truth about the world. How am I to come to know the truth about the world? Right? Well, to know the truth about the world is to know the way it would be anyway, right? The way it would be if I weren't here, right? If human beings weren't here, what would the world be like? Not the world as we interpret it. Imagine we're looking at the world through rose-tinted spectacles, right? Then we're not seeing the world as it is. We've got to take off the spectacles to see the world as it is. And the ideal put forward through the Enlightenment and subsequently in science is to know the world is to abstract away all of our prejudices, our involvement, that we have to just kind of, you know, blank out to see the world as it is. That's how you come to know, right? That's the route to knowledge. That's the route to truth. However, that idea has come into question since the, you know, early decades of the 20th century. And there's a quote here from David Cooper, who is talking about a distinction between two forms of philosophy, analytic and continental, so-called. We needn't get too involved in what the two are, but analytic philosophy, as understood back then, would pretty much accept the picture of knowledge I just gave you, right? Science tells us the way the world is. It bequeaths us that world, and then we can do some philosophical analysis about it. But science tells us the way the world is because science is objective, takes the observer out of the picture. Look what David Cooper writes here. He writes the following: the analytical enterprise is one more strategy for disenchantment. What does he mean by that? People do not stand to their language as masters of a system of rules above which they may hover in critical appraisal. But in the more intimate manner that Heidegger's metaphor is language as a house in which we dwell seeks to capture. What is he talking about there? If we try and understand our language, and we try and stand outside of it and look in from the outside, and we'll come up with a certain view. One of the views people come up with is, what do words mean? Word means the things that they refer to, right? So here you go. Bottle of water, okay? I say bottle of water. It picks this thing out. That's how the word gets its meaning. It picks things out, right? It's actually very, very difficult to make that picture work. Because when I say here, bottle of water, how do you know that those words refer to A, the bottle, and B, the water? Why wouldn't it refer to the shape? Why wouldn't it refer to the color? How do you know that? How do you know? Well, you know because you know. You're already in the game. You're in language. But think about starting from the beginning. You knew nothing, no language at all. And I pointed at that and I said, bottle. How would you know I was referring to the bottle as opposed to what's in it, its shape, its color, anything? How would you know? You only know it because you're already in the game, right? These things can't be learnt piecemeal by standing outside and pointing. We relate to our language, Heidegger says, as a house in which we dwell. We don't stand outside it, critically appraising it. And the point he's making here, and the point that many of these thinkers in the early 20th century try to make, is that there are forms of knowledge that simply cannot be revealed or uncovered by that scientific method of disengaging yourself, right? To disengage yourself, to stand outside, to look in from the outside and tell us the way things are. There are very, very important truths that are not gained that way. There are forms of knowledge that simply can't be gained that way. I'm going to give you an example here. There are many, many examples that one could give, but here's an interesting one that came up actually, you know, genuinely as a result of something that happened to me, which was that I went to the Blind Museum in Israel. Okay, I don't know if any of you have been to the Blind Museum in Israel, but, you know, wonderful, you know, really fascinating place where you walk into a museum, you are given a white stick and you go into a room and it is pitch black and you literally cannot see your hand in front of your face. And you have a blind guide who takes you around the museum, right? And takes you around this whole experience and you are completely and utterly blind and he or she, you know, they're leading you around and it's a fascinating experience, genuinely fascinating. At the end of it, when we did this, the guide says, our guide was called Mayer, and Mayer said, do you want to ask any questions? And one of the kids asked, do you dream? And Mayer said, yes, in words, right? Mayer was blind from birth. And my kid, what do you mean? How do you dream in words, right? What does that mean? And he said, I dream in words. They said, yeah, but you see black. He said, what does that mean, I see black? I mean, you know, I suppose I do, but I don't know what black looks like because I've never seen anything, right? What sight, what does it mean to see something? He doesn't know. And I don't know what it means to dream in words. Right? How do you dream in words? Pure words, no images whatsoever. I've no idea. But you know something? There is a way that is. There is something it is genuinely like either to see or in this case to dream in words, right? It's qualitative. It's not something that any scientist is going to be able to tell you. Right, scientists can tell you what's going on neurologically in terms of his brain and my brain and the differences that they can tell you. But what they cannot tell you is what's it like, right? That kind of knowledge only comes with engagement. The idea of standing back from the outside and knowing just doesn't work in that case. There are certain things you can only know if you're intimately engaged and not standing outside. And that idea becomes absolutely central from the 20th century onwards in much of philosophy and particularly in Jewish philosophy. Because suddenly The idea that certain forms of knowledge might be embedded in ways of life. They might not be universal. They might not make sense universally to any rational person. But they might make really, really good sense to people who are embedded in a certain way of life. The way it's put by Alistair MacIntyre, under B here, he says, there is no place for appeals to a practical rationality as such, or a justice as such, to which all rational persons would, by their very rationality, be compelled to give their allegiance. There is only the practical rationality of this or that tradition and the justice of this or that tradition. Now, MacIntyre's talking here again practically about practical rationality, about how we act. But what he's saying is the idea that there is a single right way to act in the world. There is practical rationality, and every person who thinks will end up in the same place is not true. Practical rationality, the way that we reason about how to act, is deeply embedded in traditions, in ways of life. And the reason that it makes perfect sense to me to keep Shabbat, and it makes absolutely no sense to somebody who isn't Jewish, right, actually makes perfect sense. Because my access, I have access to a whole lot of information that he doesn't have access to. And the point is that information isn't just information, right? It's information that's deeply embedded in the way I act. It's not pure information. Again, I taught at King's College. I taught primarily non-Jews, and I taught them a lot about Judaism, but I never got a single convert, right? I wasn't trying to, obviously. Right? But the point is that they understood a lot about Judaism, right? A lot of sentences about Judaism. They could look at it and think, oh yeah, I see how that fits together, makes sense, but didn't convince them. Because practical rationality isn't a matter of, it's not like mathematics. It's not just putting stuff together in a mathematical equation. There's something else going on. There is knowledge that I can have, that I can only have because I'm engaged. Same for my Christian friends at King's College, right? They're what they believe about Jesus, for example, makes perfect sense to someone brought up in that, who is habituated to it and habituated to ways of thinking and seeing the world. I don't think it's true, right? They don't think what I'm doing is true, but I don't think that them thinking it is irrational for them. It'd be irrational for me. Not irrational for them, because there are forms of knowledge, and religious knowledge is a perfect example, that cannot be acquired scientifically by stepping back and looking at the way the world is. It's gained by our engagement with the world. And that is the way a lot of 20th century figures do Jewish philosophy. Right? The final quote here on B is, the philosopher labors to produce a systematic account of the general conceptual structure of which our daily practice shows us to have a tacit and unconscious mastery. Right? What does a philosopher try and do according to this account? Right? We live a certain life, and that life can, behind the scenes, there's a whole string of concepts that we are unconsciously putting into practice, and the philosopher tries to uncover those concepts. Jewish philosophy can maybe do that with Judaism, right? Jewish philosophy isn't about discovering truths about the universe. Jewish philosophy on this account is to do with understanding the workings of Judaism. How does Judaism understand X? How does Judaism understand Y? How does Judaism understand the notion of tshuva, of repentance? What theory of time lies behind that view of repentance? Is it the same as the scientist theory of time? No. Does it need to be? No. Judaism can have its own theory for its own purposes while one is doing one's Jewish thing. The same way the scientist has theirs, and the Jewish scientist in the lab should use a scientific one, right? But suddenly you have a very different notion of what Jewish philosophy ought to be. It's not the medieval model or the early modern model. It's not to do with the truth about the way the world is. It's about how does Judaism approach the world? How does Judaism understand the world from its own perspective? And that needn't be shared with other perspectives. That's why we have different religions, different people within those religions who all rationally come to their conclusions about their religions, and all who think that somebody who thinks something else is wrong. Right? I unabashedly think that the theological propositions of Christianity are just plain false. Plain false. But I understand why they don't. And at the end of the day, those things are a matter of faith, right? Kant was said to limit knowledge to make room for faith, right? Knowledge has limits, and that's where faith kicks in. So in Judaism, in modern Judaism, or contemporary Judaism, or contemporary Jewish philosophy, people aren't really trying anymore to justify Judaism, right? I've already got my Judaism. Now I can justify it from within in a way that might convince Jews of the truth of what I'm saying. It's not going to convince somebody who's outside of that, but it doesn't need to. That's not the point. Judaism, incidentally, has always known that, right? We've never been on a mission. Well, you know, we've barely ever been on a mission to convert, because we get that, right? Rationality is underlain, maybe, by certain commitments. And that makes us see certain things a certain way. Now, as a result of that, you get philosophers like Martin Buber, like Franz Rosenzweig, like Rav Soloveitchik, who aren't trying to do the old medieval thing, or even the Spinoza thing, or even the Mendelssohn thing, up to a point, right? You will be hard-pressed to find in any of those thinkers an argument for the existence of God, an argument as to why the mitzvot are universally rational, right? You just won't find that, because that's no longer what they're interested in doing. Because maybe they don't think that's something you can demonstrate rationally. Maybe that isn't something that admits of that kind of scientific procedure and manipulation, right? That's something that maybe can only be understood from the inside. And from the inside, we can then go on and explain how it is we approach these things. And that's one very big part of what's going on in a lot of contemporary Jewish philosophy. Completely different, therefore, to the old project, right? The creation question doesn't exist. The prophecy question, don't get it. Tamei HaMitzvot, up to a point, but in a very, very different way from the medievals, right? Divine attributes, what does it mean to say this about God, that about God, again? Right? Not something you'll really find in those thinkers. There's one other little aspect that I'm going to mention briefly before I stop for questions, which is that in part, this is also to do with a modern critique of religion. Because the modern critique of religion often isn't so much to do with proving that it's false, right? The great critic of religion, Friedrich Nietzsche, the great 19th century German thinker, said the following. There are two quotes from Nietzsche where he says, firstly, I do not by any means know atheism as a result, even less as an event. It's a matter of course with me from instinct. I'm too inquisitive, too questionable, too exuberant to stand for any gross answer. God is a gross answer, an indelicacy against us thinkers. At bottom, merely a gross prohibition for us, you shall not think. Now, the point of that quote is Nietzsche doesn't know atheism as a result. Right? He's like, look, this isn't I haven't got an argument to prove atheism. Right? I'm an atheist by instinct. Right? Religion just doesn't make any sense to me. It just sounds like I have to shut up and not think. Right? That's what it sounds like to Nietzsche. And he goes on, religion has debased the concept man. Its ultimate consequence is that everything good, great, true is superhuman and bestowed only through an act of grace. Again, Nietzsche's concern here isn't theoretical. It's not to do with proof. Is to do with the religious way of life, right? The religious way of life for him doesn't make sense. The religious way of life for him, worse than that, is debilitating, reducing human beings to an irrelevance, making everything good and great otherworldly. And this world simply becomes, at best, maybe a test, Certainly not a place in which one can or ought to seek value. And therefore, what you find in a lot of Jewish philosophy is less a response trying to prove the existence of God, because nobody thinks you can disprove it. I say nobody, it's an exaggeration. Many people don't think you can disprove it anymore. That's not what's at stake. What's at stake for many contemporary Jewish thinkers is not theory. As Rav Soloveitchik writes here in the penultimate quote, theory is not my concern at the moment. I want instead to focus attention on a human life situation in which the man of faith as an individual concrete being with his cares and hopes, concerns and needs, joys and sad moments is entangled. What Soloveitchik's interested in is, final quote, what can a man of faith like myself, living by a doctrine which has no technical potential, by a law which cannot be tested in a laboratory, steadfast in his loyalty to an eschatological vision, eschatology is end of days, right, Moshiach, Olam Haba, whose fulfillment cannot be predicted with any degree of probability, let alone certainty, even by the most complex advanced mathematical calculations, what can such a man say to a functional utilitarian society which is secular oriented and whose practical reasons of the mind have long ago supplanted the sensitive reasons of the heart? Right, Soloveitchik's problem isn't to do with proving the existence of God, proving creation, discussing prophecy. It's what relevance does the life of faith have in the modern world? When Nietzsche says its ultimate consequence, everything great, good, true, superhuman, when Nietzsche says belief in God means do not think, is he right? Or can you actually uncover within Judaism a response to that? A response that talks of the life of faith as meaningful, as significant, even according to modern values, right? Buber does something very similar. Rosenzweig up to a point too. So in contemporary Jewish philosophy, you get a real paradigm shift. Instead of trying to tell us the way the world is, in effect, instead of trying to compete with science and philosophy, a lot of modern Jewish thought steps into Judaism and tries to interpret it from within and not from without, to try and say, look, we're Jews, this is what we are, this is how we understand the world, but what is that understanding? What is it to understand the world as a Jew? The same way for Meir, what is it to dream in words? Okay, not to justify, because maybe you can't universally justify it. Maybe you can't show why it's the rational way to act for every single human being. But what you can do is explain why it's rational for a Jew. And therefore, philosophy becomes a little more modest in its ambition, maybe, but also a little bit more useful and realistic as regards what philosophy and religion can actually contribute and what we should leave maybe to the scientists. And with that, I will pause. And we can take questions and comments and etc.
Thank you. Thank you. Much like says, I know. I see. There's already one question on the chat box, which you can take.
I
a
see
look.
A bunch of things in the chat box.
Anybody, if you want to speak up in a moment, you see that?
Yes. So, which one are we looking at here?
You can look at you can look
you
at
gave
all.
You got blind person first, and then you send that first of the experience of the rules of living. Then you can only appreciate rules if you were brought up in them. You can't figure out rules in the way that make them fit to everyone. The equation of physical division of lifestyle does not seem fair. They make sense. The lifestyle does not make sense to people in general. Okay. I use that as an example. That was mainly as an example of the idea of engaged knowledge. Right, that certain knowledge, that there are certain forms of knowledge that can only be understood via engagement, not by kind of scientific disengagement and objectivity, so-called, right? That was merely an example of a type of knowledge, right? And then using that by analogy to argue that when it comes to much contemporary, and not just Jewish philosophy, right? But there's much contemporary philosophy that believes that is the case more generally for all kinds of facets of life, and particularly, by the way, for ethics, right? For kind of, you know, ethical forms of life, religious forms of life that can differ, right? There are certain things that we would hope everybody shares, right? But there are things where you can have a reasonable disagreement And it's not clear there's a right answer to the question, right? I'm trying to think of the least controversial example I can. All the examples when you come to this are relatively controversial. You could give a perfectly coherent, even valid argument for why abortion is moral, and you could give a similar, perfectly coherent and rational and valid argument for why it's immoral, right? And the difference is the starting point, right? The difference is where are you starting from? What is the ultimate value that you're beginning from in order to give that argument? And the fact is, there is not going to be some scientific way of proving that initial evaluative starting point, right? And that's the case when it comes to these types of ethical questions. Now, there are other ethical questions where everybody's going to agree that obviously the person starting out with, you know, Jews are inferior, therefore we should commit genocide, you know, that's just a psychopath and you're not interested, right? But you're talking about decent people who can genuinely and sincerely disagree about things and disagree passionately about things, where it seems very, it's not like there's litmus paper you can put in acid or alkali, right? You're going to be starting from a very, very different place, giving very good arguments, both sides. And the idea that the distinction between them is one of them's irrational and one of them's rational, I'm not sure you're going to be able to show that. Okay, so you're right. The example was physical disability, but I do think that the you know, using it as an example to model this idea of engaged knowledge, right? I think that holds up, and that was the kind of point of using that. There are many other examples I could give, which don't involve physical disability. It's just that one was a particularly interesting one that actually happened. But you know, happy to give some others. All right. If there's no longer any point in making a universal argument for the truth of Jude, how would you make the argument for its value to your fellow Jew? How would you do it without resorting to reasoned argument? I would absolutely resort to reasoned argument. It's just not reasoned argument that starts from a premise that I would expect every human being to accept, right? So it's not to do with not having reasoned argument. You still have reasoned argument, right? That kind of reason is still, you know, front and center, absolutely essential. It's just, should I expect that reasoned argument to convince a Christian to convert? Right? It's very, very different ball game, right? So I think one can argue rationally, and I can argue in kind of all kinds of ways as to the rationality of Judaism, of even of Orthodox Judaism, right? I would happily, you know, stand up and you know, give a reasoned account of that. But it can't be that the person who isn't Jewish and hears that argument is irrational for not immediately saying, you know what, you're right. Okay? So it's kind of, this is where it's, you know, this is where it's really both interesting and challenging, right? Understanding the nature of modern Jewish philosophy as, on the one hand, like I say, less ambitious, but potentially more realistic. You did ask about the fellow Jew. I would do it and we'd see if it works, right? The fact is that when it comes even to Jewish philosophy, my fellow Jew might well not agree with me, right? Because he might be a mystic and he might think that my reasoned rational arguments are leading to conclusions he doesn't accept. Yeah, I can give my reasoned arguments, but in Jewish philosophy, as we know, there are heated debates between, you know, very different philosophies, and we can certainly give a reasoned account of them, right? But whether or not that's going to persuade, even within Judaism, frankly, you know, is a real question. There's another question about Kirov books. You've made a video like Kuzari Prutur. Are they just not so aware of the shift in policy away from it? Are they actually ignoring modern Jewish thing like Rav Soloveitchik? Yeah, it's a good question. There are very different approaches here, right? Because there are people who do still think that you can, that's why I mentioned this analytic continental philosophy divide, right? So there are absolutely still people who absolutely adhere to the old model, right? And that would be the more, you know, Mendelssohn, Spinoza, obviously not Spinoza necessarily, talking about Jewish philosophy, but there are those who would, but even they, frankly, would apply the tools of analytic philosophy, but even they wouldn't expect you to, or wouldn't expect necessarily those arguments to lead people to Judaism, maybe God, right? But I'm not sure that that kind of proof could be used to prove God, and, or certainly not Judaism, right? Maybe God, maybe, right? There is a real divide in the philosophy world over that question, right? People who think you can still use classic arguments to prove the existence of God, and people who don't. My issue there, I suppose, is I've never seen anyone be persuaded, right? I've never seen anybody who, as a result of one of those philosophical arguments, right, thinks, wow, you know what, you're right, God does exist. The people who give those arguments, people who believe already, and they're trying to show that it's rational to believe it, right? And I think that's fine. You can show it's rational to believe it, right? What it's not clear you can show is that therefore everybody ought to believe it, that its rationality isn't the same as mathematics and science, right? It's a different form of rationality. Yeah, but like I say, there is a divide there. There are those who still think you could do it, though it's notable you did mention Kira books, and they're kind of, you know, loaded in terms of doing that. They aren't kind of starting from a neutral perspective in terms of, you know, can one or can't one actually prove this, right? There's an agenda there, which isn't a problem. That's what they're trying to do, right? That's what they should be doing. But whether or not a completely neutral philosopher, if we think this is about completely neutral reason, right, could give that argument and believe that it should prove the existence of God to anyone and all comers, that I'm less sure that anybody thinks that anymore, right? People certainly think you can give probabilistic arguments that show why belief in God is at the very least as rational as disbelief, maybe even the preponderance is in favor, but to give an absolute demonstration, few and far between now, right? Few and far between. Except people are born with different temperaments, proven by science, make sense, different rules for life, make sense, different temperaments, this would seem to support your idea. Yeah, I mean, I often use the term religious sensibility, right? I do think people have different religious sensibilities. And I might have mentioned this last week, I don't recall, but, you know, I think the great strength of Judaism is that it caters to that, because it doesn't ask us to believe a particular set of dogmas, right? At least not in a particular way. Right, there are certain truths that you would expect all Jews to believe, but what they believe, the content of that, right? So you'll believe in God, right? What you pack into that might differ radically, certainly did between, say, Yehuda Halevi and the Rambam, right? But they both believe in God, but what they pack into that, very, very different, and suited their different religious sensibilities, or what you're calling there a temperament. You know, I happen to think that's the case. And like I say, I happen to think it's a great strength of Judaism that we allow that to be the case and coalesce instead around practice. Okay, are we just playing loose with the term rationality? Contemporary Jewish philosophy isn't really philosophy at all. So no, I wouldn't say that because I actually think that that is true of contemporary philosophy. Everything I've just said about Jewish philosophy is, I would contend, true of philosophy in general. And again, there are those who would disagree, but there are plenty who would agree. As in the argument I put forward about engaged knowledge, you know, that whole sort of idea doesn't come from Judaism, right? It comes from general philosophy, right? It comes from thinkers like Nietzsche. Perspectivism, right? Pluralism, those types of thinkers. And therefore, it I don't think it plays fast and loose with rationality. I think it shows that the idea of rationality with which philosophers maybe worked for a long time was in fact an illusion. right, was a chimera. That form of rationality is not, certainly not the only form of rationality. But yeah, those are much bigger questions. yes, I agree with you. Rabbi Dr. Gottlieb does think that. I disagree. but yeah, that's what I'm saying. There are people who do still think that you can, you know, completely and utterly neutrally prove these things. I'm far less convinced. But there are two sides to that, absolutely. That's for sure.
Okay, well, thank you. I noticed you didn't answer the question about why, according to Rav Soloveitchik, it's not okay to be an atheist, or why is that view not acceptable according to this?
Oh, right, yes. Why isn't the atheist worldview equally valid? I mean, to be honest, the reasons for that are in part, for him at any rate, and not just for him, there are a number of thinkers for whom this is true. I think this is certainly true of Levinas, and you can even find it possibly in Leibovitz. You can definitely find it in Berkowitz. You can find it in Boob. You can find it in a lot of these thinkers, come to think of it, is that they don't believe you can give an absolute grounding for morality without God, without the idea of transcendence, revelation, that an absolute grounding for morality, not a relative one, right, an absolute grounding maybe can only be given by appeal to something beyond, right? Again, longer discussion, but, you know, our regular heart, that is why they would have issues with that worldview.
Okay, I want to thank you, especially for taking all the questions. Tomorrow, Torah Motion presents at 11 o'clock, Tzvi Grumet, by Tzvi Grumet, live from Israel, on leadership in the Torah. 2 o'clock, we're having a special session, Mikvah, and with COVID-19, with Yoatzot Halakha, Dina Zimmerman, and Lori Novick. That's at 2 o'clock, all times Eastern. And then 8:30 tomorrow evening, Mark Shapiro, his class on the Netziv, to finish that series. So we hope you can join us for those and other classes, all on the website. Let your friends know, and thank you. And we should all be well and healthy and hear good news soon. Thank you very much.
Is there time for an oral question as well? Or like you did last time?
I'm happy to hang on if Rabbi Kelman.
It's okay with me. I don't want to. Yeah. I don't want to push you too hard. Sure,
that's okay. Sure,
Mr. Yelmanakasha.
Thank you. So here's my question.
Yeah,
I understand from what you said that your colleagues at King's College were very rational in their belief, given their experience, and you are very rational in your belief, given your experience. So let's posit a situation where you have a young man who is a Jewish fellow who is considering leaving Judaism and going to another religion.
Yeah.
Does philosophy have anything to contribute to any argument to get him to stay with Judaism? Or is that simply outside the realm because of the analytical model and what you have said?
No, sure. I think it has a role to play. As in, if somebody's already, you know, in the game, then at least there are things you can appeal to that he can potentially understand and potentially, you know, can be persuasive to him that couldn't be if he's coming with a blank slate, right? So I think there certainly is something that can be said. But at the end of the day, put it like this, I personally believe that very, very few people come to their religious beliefs as a result of rational argument, right? Rationality is usually after the fact. Yeah, the reason I'm kind of, you know, my beliefs are what they are, isn't because my mum and dad set me down at the age of 4 and explained the ontological argument and said, and that dolly face is why we keep kosher, right? And I think that's true for most of us, right? We are formed in a way that brings certain commitments, and that formation isn't in and of itself rational. Now, subsequently, you know, there are those of us who scrutinize it rationally and think, yeah, you know what, actually, I buy this, right? We're biased, right? Because we've been brought up that way. But that's fine, that's not a problem. Yeah, that is what human rationality is like across the board. We all have prejudices and commitments that lead us to see things a certain way rather than others. And we can be argued out of them, right? Because most of us, certainly in this kind of particular virtual room, are exposed to ways of life beyond our own, right? And therefore, we can genuinely, rationally scrutinize and criticize our own religion and come out thinking, yeah, but you know what? I think it stands up. I really do, right? So there's plenty we can do, but the idea that it's rational argument alone that would have the power, whether to maintain somebody within, to persuade somebody out, I'm much less convinced of. I think that most people who, you know, a lot of people who jump ship for whatever reason aren't necessarily doing it because they've studied a lot of philosophy about it, right? Well, I think usually there's all kinds of other issues there. And does philosophy have a role to play? And can it play a role? Yes. Will it be the determinative one? I don't know.
Can I follow up once more? And that is, let's take this situation. Someone goes off to college. They've grown up with the very experiences you've talked about, and they have come and they practice Judaism. Again, not because their parents explained to them at four,
but
that's the way they were raised, and you know, they're intelligent.
Yep.
And they go off to college and they're exposed to other religions, and they come back and say, boy, you know, I really thought this was right because this is what my parents told me, and I went to the Seder, and I loved it, and now I've seen others, and I'm not sure which is right, because I've seen the truths of the fellow, your colleagues at King's College as well. What do I do now?
So, like I say, there are things that, you know, there are, if you actually think that such a person could be persuaded by some kind of, you know, rational argument, philosophical argument, then there are definitely things that could be said, Whether they're going to persuade is precisely the problem I'm talking about, right? Which is, it's very difficult to think that that decision is going to be a purely rational one, right? And they're going to be irrational for taking it. It might be a deep disappointment to some of us if someone takes that right view. Whether it's irrational, that's less clear. Does that mean rational argument can help? Absolutely, right? But like I say, is it going to be the determinative factor? I don't know. I'm not sure why one would expect it to be, because, you know, human beings are more than just rational animals, right? The great mistake of Enlightenment thought is that it treated human beings like rational calculators, and we're not, right? That's part of what we are, but we're passionate beings, we're emotional beings, and that plays a role too. And any philosophy that forgets that is liable to rather overestimate its own powers.
Thanks very much.
Okay, I want to thank you again, Dr. Reinhold. And good night, everybody.
Good night, all.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.